Chapter 1. Definitions. Racist. One who is supporting a racist policy through their actions or inaction, or expressing a racist idea. Anti-racist. One who is supporting an anti-racist policy through their actions or expressing an anti-racist idea. Soul Liberation. Swayed on stage at the University of Illinois Arena, rocking colorful dashikis and afros that shot up like ball fists, an amazing sight to behold for the 11,000 college students in the audience. Soul Liberation appeared nothing like the white ensembles and suits who had been sounding hymns for nearly 2 days after Jesus' birthday in 1970. Black students had succeeded in pushing the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, the U.S. evangelical movement's premier college organizer, to devote the second night of the conference to Black theology. More than 500 Black attendees from across the country were on hand as Soul Liberation began to perform. Two of those Black students were my parents. They were not sitting together. Days earlier, they had ridden on the same bus for 22 hours that felt like 42, from Manhattan through Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana, before arriving in central Illinois. 100 Black New Yorkers converged on InterVarsity's Urbana 70. My mother and father had met during the Thanksgiving break weeks earlier when Larry, an accounting student at Manhattan's Baruch College, co-organized a recruiting event for Urbana 70 at his church in Jamaica, Queens. Carol was one of the 30 people who showed up. She had come home to Queens from Nyack College, a small Christian school about 45 miles north of her parents' home in Far Rockaway. The first meeting was uneventful, but Carol noticed Larry, an overly serious student with a towering afro, his face hidden behind a forest of facial hair. And Larry noticed Carol, a petite 19-year-old with dark freckles sprayed over her caramel complexion, even if all they did was exchange small talk. They'd independently decided to go to Urbana 70 when they heard that Tom Skinner would be preaching and Soul Liberation would be performing. At 28 years old, Skinner was growing famous as a young evangelist of Black liberation theology. A former gang member and son of a Baptist preacher, he reached thousands via his weekly radio show and tours, where he delivered sermons at packed iconic venues like the Apollo Theater in his native Harlem. In 1970, Skinner published his third and fourth books, How Black is the Gospel and Words of Revolution. Carol and Larry devoured both books like a James Brown tune, like a Muhammad Ali fight. Carol had discovered Skinner through his younger brother Johnny, who was enrolled with her at NIAC. Larry's connection was more ideological. In the spring of 1970, he had enrolled in The Black Aesthetic, a class taught by legendary Baruch College literary scholar Addison Gale, Jr. For the first time, Larry read James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, Richard Wright's Native Son, Amiri Baraka's Wrenching Plays, and the banned Revolutionary Manifesto, The Spook Who Sat by the Door by Sam Greenlee. It was an awakening. After Gale's class, Larry started searching for a way to reconcile his faith with his newfound Black consciousness. That search led him to Tom Skinner. Soul Liberation launched into their popular anthem, Power to the People. The bodies of Black students who had surged to the front of the arena started moving almost in unison with the sounds of booming drums and heavy bass that, along with syncopated claps, generated the rhythm and blues of a rural Southern revival. The wave of rhythm then rushed through the thousands of white bodies in the arena. Before long, they, too, were on their feet, swaying and singing along to the soulful sounds of Black power. Every chord from Soul Liberation seemed to build up anticipation for the keynote speaker to come. When the music ended, it was time. Tom Skinner, dark-suited, with a red tie, stepped behind the podium, his voice serious as he began his history lesson. The evangelical church supported the status quo. It supported slavery. It supported segregation. It preached against any attempt of the Black man to stand on his own two feet. Skinner shared how he came to worship an elite white Jesus Christ who cleaned people up through rules and regulations, a savior who prefigured Richard Nixon's vision of law and order. But one day, Skinner realized that he'd gotten Jesus wrong. Jesus wasn't in the Rotary Club, and he wasn't a policeman. Jesus was a radical revolutionary with hair on his chest and dirt under his fingernails. Skinner's new idea of Jesus was born of and committed to a new reading of the gospel. Any gospel that does not speak to the issue of enslavement and injustice and inequality, any gospel that does not want to go where people are hungry and poverty-stricken and set them free in the name of Jesus Christ, is not the gospel. Back in the days of Jesus, there was a system working just like today, Skinner declared. But Jesus was dangerous. He was dangerous because he was changing the system. The Romans locked up this revolutionary and nailed him to a cross and killed him and buried him. But 3 days later, Jesus Christ got up out of the grave to bear witness to us today, proclaim liberation to the captives, preach sight to the blind, and go into the world and tell men who are bound mentally, spiritually, and physically, the liberator has come. The last line pulsated through the crowd. The liberator has come. Students practically leapt out of their seats in an ovation, taking on the mantle of this fresh gospel. The liberators had come. My parents were profoundly receptive to Skinner's call for evangelical liberators and attended a series of Black caucuses over the week of the conference that reinforced his call every night. At Urbana 70, Ma and Dad found themselves leaving the civilizing and conserving and racist church they realized they'd been part of. They were saved into Black liberation theology and joined the churchless church of the Black Power Movement, born in the days of Malcolm X, Fannie Lou Hamer, Stokely Carmichael, and other anti-racists who confronted segregationists and assimilationists in the 1950s and 1960s. The movement for Black solidarity, Black cultural pride, and Black economic and political self-determination had enraptured the entire Black world. And now, in 1970, Black power had enraptured my parents. They stopped thinking about saving Black people and started thinking about liberating Black people. In the spring of 1971, Ma returned to Nyack College and helped form a Black student union, an organization that challenged racist theology, the Confederate flags on dorm room doors, and the paucity of Black students in programming. She started wearing African print dresses and wrapped her growing afro in African print ties. She dreamed of traveling to the motherland as a missionary. Dad returned to his church and quit its famed youth choir. He began organizing programs that asked provocative questions. Is Christianity the white man's religion? Is the Black church relevant to the Black community? He began reading the work of James Cone, the scholarly father of Black Liberation Theology and author of the influential Black Theology and Black Power in 1969. One day, in the spring of 1971, Dad struck up the nerve to go up to Harlem and attend Cone's class at Union Theological Seminary. Cone lectured on his new book, A Black Theology of Liberation. After class, Dad approached the professor. "What is your definition of a Christian?" Dad asked in his deeply earnest way. Cone looked at Dad with equal seriousness and responded, "A Christian is one who is striving for liberation." James Cone's working definition of a Christian described a Christianity of the enslaved, not the Christianity of the slaveholders. Receiving this definition was a revelatory moment in Dad's life. Ma had her own similar revelation in her Black student union that Christianity was about struggle and liberation. My parents now had, separately, arrived at a creed with which to shape their lives, to be the type of Christians that Jesus the Revolutionary inspired them to be. This new definition of a word that they'd already chosen as their core identity naturally transformed them. My own still ongoing journey toward being an anti-racist began at Urbana 70. What changed Ma and Dad led to a changing of their two unborn sons. This new definition of the Christian life became the creed that grounded my parents' lives and the lives of their children. I cannot disconnect my parents' religious strivings to be Christian from my secular strivings to be an anti-racist. And the key act for both of us was defining our terms so that we could begin to describe the world and our place in it. Definitions anchor us in principles. This is not a light point. If we don't do the basic work of defining the kind of people we want to be in language that is stable and consistent, we can't work towards stable, consistent goals. Some of my most consequential steps towards being an anti-racist have been the moments when I arrived at basic definitions. To be an anti-racist is to set lucid definitions of racism, anti-racism, racist, anti-racist policies, racist, anti-racist ideas, racist, anti-racist people. To be a racist is to constantly redefine racist in a way that exonerates one's changing policies, ideas, and personhood. So let's set some definitions. What is racism? Racism is a marriage of racist policies and racist ideas that produces and normalizes racial inequities. Okay, so what are racist policies and ideas? We have to define them separately to understand why they are married and why they interact so well together. In fact, let's take one step back and consider the definition of another important phrase, racial inequity. Racial inequity is when two or more racial groups are not standing on approximately equal footing. Here's an example of racial inequity. 71% of white families lived in owner-occupied homes in 2014, compared to 45% of Latinx families and 41% of Black families. Racial equity is when two or more racial groups are standing on a relatively equal footing. An example of racial equity would be if there were relatively equitable percentages of all three racial groups living in owner-occupied homes in the 40s, 70s, or better, 90s. A racist policy is any measure that produces or sustains racial inequity between racial groups. An anti-racist policy is any measure that produces or sustains racial equity between racial groups. By policy, I mean written and unwritten laws, rules, procedures, processes, regulations, and guidelines that govern people. There's no such thing as a non-racist or race-neutral policy. Every policy, in every institution, in every community, in every nation, is producing or sustaining either racial inequity or equity between racial groups. Racist policies have been described by other terms: institutional racism, structural racism, and systemic racism, for instance. But those are vaguer terms than racist policy. When I use them, I find myself having to immediately explain what they mean. Racist policy is more tangible and exacting, and more likely to be immediately understood by people, including its victims, who may not have the benefit of extensive fluency in racial terms. Racist policy says exactly what the problem is and where the problem is. Institutional racism and structural racism and systemic racism are redundant. Racism itself is institutional, structural, and systemic. Racist policy also cuts to the core of racism better than racial discrimination, another common phrase. Racial discrimination is an immediate and visible manifestation of an underlying racial policy. When someone discriminates against a person in a racial group, they are carrying out a policy or taking advantage of the lack of a protective policy. We all have the power to discriminate. Only an exclusive few have the power to make policy. Focusing on racial discrimination takes our eyes off of the central agents of racism. Racist policy and racist policymakers are what I call racist power. Since the 1960s, racist power has commandeered the term racial discrimination, transforming the act of discriminating on the basis of race into an inherently racist act. But if racial discrimination is defined as treating, considering, or making a distinction in favor or against an individual based on that person's race, then racial discrimination is not inherently racist. The defining question is whether the discrimination is creating equity or inequity. If discrimination is creating equity, then it is anti-racist. If discrimination is creating inequity, then it is racist. Someone reproducing inequity through permanently assisting an overrepresented racial group into wealth and power is entirely different than someone challenging that inequity by temporarily assisting an underrepresented racial group into relative wealth and power until equity is reached. The only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. As President Lyndon B. Johnson said in 1965, "You do not take a person who, for years, has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bring him up to the starting line of a race, and then say, you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair." As U.S. Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun wrote in 1978, "In order to get beyond racism, we must first take account of race. There is no other way. In order to treat some persons equally, we must treat them differently." The racist champions of racist discrimination engineer to maintain racial inequities before the 1960s are now the racist opponents of anti-racist discrimination engineer to dismantle those racial inequities. The most threatening racist movement is not the alt-right's unlikely drive for a white ethnostate, but the regular American drive for a race-neutral one. The construct of race neutrality actually feeds white nationalist victimhood by positing the notion that any policy protecting or advancing non-white Americans towards equity is reverse discrimination. That is how racist power can call affirmative action policies that succeed in reducing racial inequities race-conscious and standardized tests that produce racial inequities race-neutral. That is how they can blame the behavior of entire racial groups for the inequities between different racial groups and still say their ideas are not racist. But there is no such thing as a not racist idea, only racist ideas and anti-racist ideas. So what is a racist idea? A racist idea is any idea that suggests one racial group is inferior or superior to another racial group in any way. Racist ideas argue that the inferiorities and superiorities of racial groups explain racial inequities in society, as Thomas Jefferson suspected a decade after declaring white American independence. The blacks, whether originally a distinct race or made distinct by time and circumstances, are inferior to the whites in the endowments both of body and mind. An anti-racist idea is any idea that suggests the racial groups are equals in all their apparent differences, that there is nothing right or wrong with any racial group. Anti-racist ideas argue that racist policies are the cause of racial inequities. Understanding the differences between racist policies and anti-racist policies, between racist ideas and anti-racist ideas, allows us to return to our fundamental definitions. Racism is a powerful collection of racist policies that lead to racial inequity and are substantiated by racist ideas. Anti-racism is a powerful collection of anti-racist policies that lead to racial equity and are substantiated by anti-racist ideas. Once we have a solid definition of racism and anti-racism, we can start to make sense of the racialized world around us, before us. My maternal grandparents, Mary Ann and Alvin, moved their family to New York City in the 1950s on the final leg of the Great Migration, happy to get their children away from violent Georgia segregationists and the work of picking cotton under the increasingly hot Georgia sun. To think they were also moving their family away from the effects of climate change. Do-nothing climate policy is racist policy, since the predominantly non-white global South is being victimized by climate change more than the whiter global North, even as the whiter global North is contributing more to its acceleration. Land is sinking and temperatures are rising from Florida to Bangladesh. Droughts and food scarcity are ravishing bodies in eastern and southern Africa, a region already containing 25% of the world's malnourished population. Human-made environmental catastrophes disproportionately harming bodies of color are not unusual. For instance, nearly 4,000 U.S. areas, mostly poor and non-white, have higher lead poisoning rates than Flint, Michigan. I am one generation removed from picking cotton for pocket change under the warming climate in Guyton outside Savannah. That's where we buried my grandmother in 1993. Memories of her comforting calmness, her dark green thumb, and her large trash bags of Christmas gifts lived on as we drove back to New York from her funeral. The next day, my father ventured up to Flushing, Queens, to see his single mother, also named Marianne. She had the clearest dark brown skin, a smile that hugged you, and a wit that smacked you. When my father opened the door of her apartment, he smelled the fumes coming from the stove she'd left on, and some other fumes. His mother, nowhere in sight, he rushed down the hallway and into the back bedroom. That's where he found his mother, as if sleeping, but dead. Her struggle with Alzheimer's, a disease more prevalent among African Americans, was over. There may be no more consequential white privilege than life itself. White lives matter to the tune of 3.5 additional years over Black lives in the United States, which is just the most glaring of a host of health disparities, starting from infancy, where Black infants die at twice the rate of white infants. But at least my grandmothers and I met. We shared. We loved. I never met my paternal grandfather. I never met my maternal grandfather, Alvin, killed by cancer 3 years before my birth. In the United States, African Americans are 25% more likely to die of cancer than whites. My father survived prostate cancer, which kills twice as many Black men as it does white men. Breast cancer disproportionately kills Black women. 3 million African Americans and 4 million Latinx secured health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, dropping uninsured rates for both groups to around 11% before President Barack Obama left office. But a staggering 28.5 million Americans remained uninsured, a number primed for growth after Congress repealed the individual mandate in 2017. And it is becoming harder for people of color to vote out of office, the politicians crafting these policies designed to shorten their lives. Racist voting policy has evolved from disenfranchising by Jim Crow voting laws to disenfranchising by mass incarceration and voter ID laws. Sometimes these efforts are so blatant that they are struck down. North Carolina enacted one of these targeted voter ID laws, but in July 2016, the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit struck it down, ruling that its various provisions target African Americans with almost surgical precision. But others have remained and been successful. Wisconsin's strict voter ID law suppressed approximately 200,000 votes, again primarily targeting voters of color in the 2016 election. Donald Trump won that critical swing state by 22,748 votes. We are surrounded by racial inequity, as visible as the law, as hidden as our private thoughts. The question for each of us is, what side of history will we stand on? A racist is someone who is supporting a racist policy by their actions or inaction, or expressing a racist idea. An anti-racist is someone who is supporting an anti-racist policy by their actions or expressing an anti-racist idea. Racist and anti-racist are like peelable name tags that are placed and replaced based on what someone is doing or not doing, supporting or expressing in each moment. These are not permanent tattoos. No one becomes a racist or anti-racist. We can only strive to be one or the other. We can unknowingly strive to be a racist. We can knowingly strive to be an anti-racist. Like fighting an addiction, being an anti-racist requires persistent self-awareness, constant self-criticism, and regular self-examination. Racist ideas have defined our society since its beginning and can feel so natural and obvious as to be banal, But anti-racist ideas remain difficult to comprehend, in part because they go against the flow of this country's history. As Audre Lorde said in 1980, we have all been programmed to respond to the human differences between us with fear and loathing, and to handle that difference in one of three ways. Ignore it, and if that is not possible, copy it if we think it is dominant, or destroy it if we think it is subordinate. But we have no patterns for relating across our human differences as equals. To be an anti-racist is a radical choice in the face of this history, requiring a radical reorientation of our consciousness.